brand creative outperforms performance messaging 80% of the time. And it was dark to me, right? Because that always seemed a little bit kumbaya sitting around on beanbags.
And that statistic, is that in the short term?
Even in the short term.
Welcome back to the Smarter Marketer podcast. I'm here today with Paul Sinkinson. Paul, welcome to the pod.
Thank you very much.
Very, very excited for today's conversation. So Paul has been Managing Director of Australia of Analytic Partners for the past 8 years. Analytic Partners is a global marketing consultancy that works with organizations to help them understand the impact of their marketing spend. Paul has over 20 years of analytics and marketing measurement experience working with Australia as well as leading global brands around the world. I saw Paul present at South by Southwest last year as part of a discussion around the new era of marketing accountability. I found it fascinating. I think there was lots of information being shared that lots of marketers that I deal with would nod in agreement and you'd be saying a lot of things that I think a lot of us feel but often don't have the data to prove it. So today we're going to be discussing, I guess, the holy grail of marketing, measuring the impact of marketing. Big topic area, thinking about today's pod. And every marketer I speak to, everyone in our agency, we've all heard that, you know, just prove it's working and I'll spend more. You know, I know half of my marketing budget's wasted. I just don't know which half.
Yeah.
What do you see the biggest challenges for marketers out there? I've probably got some kind of my thoughts on it, but I'll be curious as to like, what are those, the challenges that you find marketers are having in kind of getting buy-in and adoption?
Some businesses, and I'll talk, you know, when I was client side, some businesses, marketing is viewed as the Chardonnay and the Crown Brigade, right? Which is, you know, like a horrendous indictment on the profession. But, you know, it's what some old sales directors have definitely said in meetings that I've been in before. So there's that credibility. There's having hard metrics as well. Like if marketing's sitting there talking about awareness or intent and this sort of stuff, and the rest of the business is talking about sales, you get that misalignment and immediately you kind of get left out of some of those discussions because you can't contribute or link into it. I think, you know, CMO turnover is probably another one as well. Like having that network, you know, you kind of see those CMOs who lean into those discussions and bring people along from the start. So it being very much a senior stakeholder engagement is I think, the key to overcoming it.
I think in terms of the clients that we work with, we're working in the kind of performance digital space, right? And the more transactional that a product might be, generally it's getting easier for us to kind of say this channel is working for you guys, and if you do this and if you do that, you know, we can show a return on investment and attribution paths to purchase. For clients that are on a kind of much more complex path to purchase, longer buyer cycle, often, you know, more B2B than B2C, in terms of what you're doing, like I think a lot of our clients in that complex path to purchase would just love the idea of ice cream and weather and summer and winter and those types of things. How do you find it on your side of the fence when you are dealing with slower moving sales cycles, lots of stakeholders, lots of touch points compared to something that might be a little bit more transactional?
It's a fun one, to be honest. Mm. I mean, you know, there's more data, there's more complexity there, and so it's great. The time lag is a big one.
Mm.
I'm so playing, and I think, you know, that's one of the fundamentals that I'll, you know, hopefully be able to go on and on about as we kind of progress around the long term versus the short term. But I think if we could kind of touch on that transactional digital attribution part to start with, it's one of the challenges that we've got now that we didn't have when attribution started. You know, I'm old, you can kind of see some of these gray hairs coming through. So, you know, I
for those listening, Paul's stroking the side of his hair.
You know, when it started, we had every data point that was sitting there, right? So we had every interaction that you did. We could track everywhere you'd been on the internet before you came to our site through, you know, the magic of cookies, and we'd know exactly that path to purchase. There was always that argument of online versus offline activity, right? Of like, oh, look, you know, you're not accounting for offline things, but at least in the online world, we knew everything. Mm. It was all fine. Now we don't. So, you know, if you look at it within, you know, like iOS, right, 54% of Australians opted out of cross-site tracking, which means that you're getting a dead signal. In terms of ad blockers, like 36% of Australians have got ad blockers. Now that, you know, Google's kind of restricting access to some stuff, hopefully that comes down a bit. But that's still a massive amount, which means you don't have all of that data coming through. So, you know, we did an experiment looking at some of our clients' data, seeing what's the impact of that, of not having the data, let alone, you know, like anything else, but just violating that assumption of having all of the online data. What's the impact of it? We recreated some attribution models, just a mixed model approach, but we saw 59% of the online events and interactions were missing because of those factors, which is massive, right? We dug into it to look at, well, what's the impact on conversions then? But you're only missing 8% of the conversions, which kind of stumped me a bit, right? How can it be these so big? But then you realize the way that most of the models have been done through, like Adobe or GA, you've still got that search component. You've still got like that last thing that people did. So you're picking up that. But what it does mean is, in the old days, there used to be an average of like four interactions on each journey. It's around, like say around two to two and a half at the moment. But as you take out that data from the likes of ad blockers and from cross-app tracking, comes down to 1.4. You're missing a whole lot of stuff. And it means that then that impact isn't equal across all channels. Missing, say, 80% of the social impact. You're missing 30% of video. You're not seeing what things are actually driving the impact, which means you're going to invest wrong, right? You're going to overinvest in other things and you're going to underinvest in social and video as a result of it, just because of the data degradation. It's a real problem, right? Of knowing. Thinking we know what we do, but because our view of it's getting smaller and smaller, it's only going to get worse with more walled gardens. So I think that, like a mixed model's needed, and there's actually even complexity in those things that we think are simple and short term and transactional, buying something online. I think that there's more to it. But I think as well, a lot of the base value's been extracted out of some of that transactional stuff. So now it's the combination of things. Is where, the real value creation is for our clients, right? So what digital activity do you do? What stuff do you do in relation to external conditions and when, seasonality? How do you scale that when, your client's doing a whole lot of TV? What does that mean you should be doing and when, right? Embracing the complexity is kind of key. And then, that kind of comes down to how you deal with data, because there's loads and loads of it, right? Clearly. How you stop yourself getting drowning in it really, and how you deal with, data deprecation and data gaps. If you don't have the data for it, an experiment can create it for you.
Yeah, interesting. And it is just so true where might be a similar age, where I think there has been this journey where I kind of came into this space from performance digital very much. Paid search ads, right? And back in the day, it was so linear. It was, we would go out there and say, give us a test budget, right? Let us test against what you're getting through Yellow Pages or leaflet drops or whatever it might be. Give us X amount of money, I'll get you this many clicks, this many leads. If the sales from the leads outweighs, the spend, you'll keep spending more. And as a community, digital marketers kind of put forward this notion that everything can be measured and all decisions should be made on data. We've now this kind of confluence of issues, right? One is exactly what you mentioned in terms of privacy and the data that we used to once get, we are no longer getting. Data itself isn't always accurate, right? Like what we see in GA is kind of an estimate, it's an aggregation, it's a model, it's what Google thinks might be happening. We look at that data versus what we see in platform, which will be different again. And then I think we've also just got the reality, which is things are more complex now, right? Where it's more unlikely now that that path will be one click. Fill out a form and away we go. And it's months and months of being nurtured, and it's things you might see on YouTube or things you might see on LinkedIn that then you might say to someone in the real world, which will then drive a real world action. And it is very difficult. What advice would you give to a marketer, and maybe a marketer that doesn't have millions of dollars being invested in their marketing budget in TV and social and every channel, but just practically, like what would be some ways that you might want to demonstrate or test that whatever you're doing is social may or may not be working? Or like how do you advocate for, I think a constant push we have is sales. You kind of touched on the gnarly old sales director. Marketing should be driving leads, and we want to run this campaign and generate leads. And often it's kind of like, yeah, but we haven't been doing the brand work for the last 2 years to generate those leads. Like what are some practical tips that you'd give to a marketer in that kind of environment?
It's an interesting one, right? And this is where I go and almost contradict myself because everything I think in measurement's relative rather than being absolute. So smaller clients, that's still where performance marketing and pumping your money into some search works a treat,
Yeah,
right?
good. Speak to a rocket agency.
There's definitely a trade-off as you get bigger and people know your brand and you've got distribution, digital distribution, physical distribution, you've got brand awareness, you've got brand considerations. And there's that tipping point where, and it always should be, look, is your organic search growing or is your organic search coming down as your paid search goes up or down? And I think, there's those sorts of litmus tests that you can do of when, at what point should you come off performance marketing. Because definitely when you're starting out, there's nothing that's going to be so efficient and drive such great results for you, right? As you scale, then you need to start to transform and into other things with that paid activity. And particularly when you're small, it can literally be as simple as on and off, particularly if it's genuine performance. Because if you're not doing creative, brand creative that is supposed to work over a longer time period, it's going to decay very quickly. So you'll be able to show it. So I think at a small scale, it is actually staying with that stuff and going for it.
Yeah.
So as you get bigger, I think, a lot of people think that you need to have this tremendous scale to be able to have, decent measurement. But I think that you can get there pretty quickly on small spends.
Yeah. And we definitely come across so many clients that have kind of gone through that first phase of growth, and it often is running, hard-nosed performance campaigns, SEO, Google Ads, word of, and then like word of mouth marketing, maybe some kind of sales-oriented activity. And it's that next bit, which is like we've hit these initial growth goals, and now we need that next phase of growth. And I think it is often this expectation that what worked before will keep working, and it just doesn't. It feels to me that is when you start needing to go out there and do a lot of the brand work, which is that next tier of growth.
Exactly. And that's where you can start seeing that cannibalization, right, of organic activity, where you can start having it, your paid activity coming in and just be picking up that organic stuff that your other marketing is driving for you. Look, if you were a business and you're pretty confident that you're going to become like a $100 million business and you're going towards it, my recommendation is to invest the time up front in coming up with some great brand creative. And when I say creative, I mean a creative platform, right? Because you want to be building out some distinctive assets that you can hold on to for like 10 years. You want to be building creative that you can hold on to for a long time. When we run these models for larger clients, it's a controversial one. It was definitely challenging for me because I come from a trade background in retail, right? Like, stack it high, put a special sticker on it and watch it fly out of the store. But brand creative outperforms performance messaging 80% of the time. And it was dark to me, right? Because that always seemed a little bit kumbaya sitting around on beanbags.
And that statistic, is that in the short term?
Even in the short term, there's a few reasons for it, right? It's not because like brand creative makes us feel emotional or something like that. Well, there's definitely probably a part of that, but there's two also functional cold hard ones that do it. Brand ad hits your entire business, right? So we always have this metric that we call business size exposed. If you're selling, say, 20 widgets and you do an ad for widget one, come in and buy widget one, it's going to give you, say, like 100% lift on widget one sales, but nothing on widgets 2 to 20, or like very little on it. But if you do an ad for the entire business, it might only give you a 10 to 15% lift, but it gives it across all of those widgets. So because it exposes more of the business, that halo, it drives more business for you
What
overall.
did you, sorry, what did you describe that as, that metric or that
Business size exposed. So just how much that ad is kind of like touching when it tries to promote it to people. And the other one is how long you can keep that creative working for you, right? Because if you're putting out a price point, obviously once that special's over, you've got to take it out of market. You can't use it anymore. If you're promoting a product, that product's no longer in store or in your range, you've got to take it off. But that brand ad, you can keep going for as long as until it does wear out, which is, like one of the other fun stats that we've got of having tested, 51,000 odd bits of creative to see if they're financially worn out, not like worn out. That financial wear out, I mean, was the cost of making that new creative offset by this tremendous return you got from putting in the new creative. And after 51,000 that we tested 14 times, yes, it had worn out, but every other time it hadn't.
Well, I think I was looking back at my notes from your session at South by Southwest, and a question was asked to you, how long can a campaign go for? And your response was, I don't know, because a marketer has killed it before I could tell you. And
Yeah,
the whole room
exactly.
laughed.
It is right. Because clearly it's going to wear out at some point, but we just do it so quickly. I mean, I've even seen people make TV campaigns and run them for like 300 taps, and that's it ever, which is criminal, right? I've got some of my larger clients who do 300 taps in 1 week. It's really important, I think, to realize that you can run things for longer and that a brand creative is that very thing. And that's, just even the platform, right? So you'd be switching out the creative under the same platform and getting greater and greater value for it. I mean, we've had one client who was doing it inconsistently. It was at least 15% of their budget, but it was inconsistent. They'd do it for, so like an 8 week campaign, a whole lot of time off, another 6 weeks. They really kind of doubled down on it, ran it for 40 weeks of the year. So it's at least 25% of their budget. And after 4 years, that ROI went up 2.5 times. Same platform. So instead of getting, say, a dollar, they were getting $2.50 just from being consistent behind it. And that's why we always say that, consistency is the unheralded superhero of marketing effectiveness. Just don't change it. Every time that you think, oh, I think we should change this, don't. Wait until the third time that you think you should change it, and then maybe.
It's a great line. Do you have any rules of thumb around that? Like back in the day, it cost $2 million to make a beer ad, and then we're going to spend X amount of million on amplifying it. Is it that kind of way of doing it, or are you just looking at it and this hard-nosed, I don't care until I start to see metrics that suggest that prove that, the audience is sick and tired of seeing this ad? Like, what are you looking for, or how do you set it up?
I would really, I'm just looking to see the result fall away. So we're just kind of seeing, look, is the response from showing that ad getting lower? I think the thing is as well, because, like once again, as I say, in mix, it's always about the mix, right? It's never black and white, this good, that bad. It's always how much. It's not just about having brand. You also need, your performance marketing coming in. So as that brand ad does maybe start to wear out a bit, you're putting your performance metrics on there. Like if you're a retailer, could you just have brand year round and that it? No, definitely not. You particularly going into the current conditions we've got, right? You need to be saying, hey, we're good price. We're good value. You need to be reinforcing those hygiene basic table stakes. So you're doing that at the same time, which then also means that you kind of give the creative chance to freshen up and people to not get too bored of it.
Because obviously the mix of brand and short-term demand gen performance, whatever we call it, jump around depending on the industry and the customer and the client. Would you generally suggest that, like, the long and the short of it, Benet and Fields is a good place for people to start in terms of what that mix should be for them in their industry?
To be honest, I think it's a bit risky at the moment. The reason why I say it's risky, I think it's where everybody should end up at an average, once again. And there's a bit of very, very clear, look, this is an average. The problem with moving, like if you are 90-10 the other way around, right? You're cycling against those numbers. So you need to be showing, hey, like sales are down this week. We pulled out of our price and performance. What do we know? That pays off right at the time, right? It's got an immediate response and feedback for us. So you're taking away from that for stuff that pays off better, but pays off over a long time. So it's a skyscraper standing up or it's a skyscraper down on its side, right? But you've got all of those weeks to wait until that comes through and until you get that scale. And there's a lot of businesses that don't have that luxury at the moment, right? To sell and take a 20% hit in sales while they wait for it to come back with the knowledge it will, but can they wait that long? So I think it's about small steps towards it. And I think that's kind of the key. And we do see a lot of people make those knee-jerk changes and go fully the other way. And then the CFO goes, whoa, what's going on? Last month's trading was terrible. And so they jump back the other way. And then they go, oh, brand doesn't work because they did it for like 1 month. And it takes a long time for that to build. So my advice would very much be small steps towards it. What we've seen is once you get under 30% of your spend on brand, your ROIs are punished because your brand activity makes your performance activity perform better. There's a synergy between them, right? If you've got brand activity going on, there's a synergy. It means that your price works better, your search works better, because when you pop up, people go, oh, I know that one. It's an acceptable brand, right? And so there's a benefit from it. So I'm not saying that 30% is where you should be. All I'm saying is 30% is the floor. So it's somewhere above 30%. It's probably, where Les and Peter say, but be aware that under that level, you're doing harm. We definitely know that even your performance ROIs fall away then.
Yeah, interesting. I think it segues maybe nicely. Like, Mark Ritson has a line around great brand creative will drive short-term sales, but rarely does great short-term activity drive long-term sales. And I think and it probably then ties into what you're saying before, right? Which is the brand messaging, it does out perform short for those reasons that you explained. But I think then obviously a lot of it comes down to the creative, right? And if you're going to go off kind of knee-jerk and put out in market a pretty average brand campaign and try to test it after a month, you're setting yourself up for failure. But when we talk about creative, I guess, like, I love the idea of talking creative with someone in an organization that is so metric driven, right? Like, how important is creative?
Massively. So if you're talking video, I get into these discussions, right? I'll sit there with all these metrics. So we'll be, I said before on TV, what day of week's best? What weight should you be? What demographic should you be going after? What shows? What duration? What network? what time of the year, all of these sorts of factors. And they drive a third of your potential ROI improvement. Two-thirds of it comes from the creative. That thing where we go, I like that one with about that much science in it often, right? There's testing that happens, but it's still very much an art, which is something that I'm never going to try and put too much scientific rigor behind. I'm great at measuring the impact of it. And what we know is it's vitally important, driving two-thirds of that value, which is why I say it's worth investing the time to make sure that you've got it right rather than rushing it. The other reason why it's worth taking the time is that thing that you're trying to replace probably hasn't worn out, so it can last for a little bit longer while you take the time to invest and do it properly.
It's a great backwards way of thinking of it, I think. I know there was a Nielsen study, I think it was a year, maybe a year or two ago. I can't remember. Is that where you get the two-thirds, one-third effectiveness,
No,
or?
this is based off our work where we've kind of done it. So, it's you go through, you can only do it retrospectively and where there's, creative testing, because you can take in then, the pre-test scores and post-test scores. You can take, the reach that it actually achieved and all that sort of stuff. So it's a retrospective thing, looking back to see how much of the impact that had.
I can't remember the exact number, but I think very similar. It was kind of, and I was, it's quite incredible how that the percentage of importance of creative kind of dwarfs the way the media is being bought. And then second of all, the brand, right? Obviously the brand matters as
Well,
well, but
100%. And it can be hard sometimes to get people to realize, one, the impact of brand, but also the impact of things not wearing out. And it was one of the, obviously COVID was a horrendous thing for everybody. For some marketing analysts, it actually created some opportunities we never would have otherwise been able to have. So, we had one client who, because they had supply issues, they had to pull all their performance advertising because they didn't have enough supply. They couldn't put the price promotions out there. They couldn't have some products, so they couldn't advertise those. So they just had brand advertising, and even that at low weights because they were worried about, what was going to happen because it was brand that was holding it up. And it was the one time we were able to show somebody, by them only having brand on for about, 8 weeks, 12 weeks even, the impact that brand was having.
really interesting.
Yeah, so never would have been able to get them to do it because it was, like a major advertiser. The other one was a beer brand. Like beer brands, they always make these big, beautiful ads, right? Like, 60-second, definitely getting entered into a creative show. Because of lockdowns, they couldn't get out making a creative, so they had to show the same old one from this very room doing the presentation. They're like, oh God, Paul, how bad was it?
Numbers are going to be
Use
bad.
the
You're like,
same thing.
best I've ever been.
Yeah, exactly. It had finally had a chance to wear in. It was a higher ROI than ever before because people now knew it, and it was able to do that job of reminding people rather than having to build the memory structures, build those associations. It was instead leveraging what had already been built.
And you can test that even against, because obviously beer at the time was would have been sales would have been upright with us all drinking way too much than we should have at home. You can kind of measure that equally.
Yeah, and that's the benefit of commercial mix modeling, right? I mean, the hard reality is marketing, in the short term at least, is doing somewhere between 5 or 10% of total sales. It's the other 90, it's not even 80-20, it's like 90-10 or 95-5 of what's driving it. So we spend most of our time working on the 90 to 95 and then get to the marketing media side of things.
Yeah, amazing that I think we'll look back in 20 years' time and COVID will have been this kind of laboratory for what happens when you keep kids, homeschooled for a year and, telehealth and all these other things. I wouldn't have thought that it was going to be, testing how long a beer ad should run for.
Exactly.
Not bad. I'm not sure if you'll have an answer for this, but the hallmarks of good creative, or is this just something you don't really kind of pay that much attention to, or is it something you pay a lot of attention to?
Look, on TV, I spend less time looking at it because we've been doing it for so long that I think we're getting good at knowing what's going to be good creative and what's not. Well, we're getting good at picking bad creative, let's say that. Maybe we're not great at picking good creative, but we're good at picking, turkeys. Spend a lot of time looking at online creative because there's a huge variation. The variation's really, really broad because we're still figuring it out. And there's a lot of stuff that can easily be done. We're learning in this space. If you've got your creative fit for purpose, your ROI can be 3.5 times higher. And that's not just a digital thing, right? It's like out of home even. Out of home advertising is always the afterthought. What is it? Is it a pack shot or is it the end frame of the TVC? It's one of the two, right? Very, very rarely does it get the same sort of creative thought and investment that a TV ad does. But it's the same with a lot of video, right? It's the TVC. It's not good enough. So, there's things like tighter frame shots. Definitely needed. You can't have these huge vistas because the screen's smaller, right? Brighter, high contrast colors, getting movement happening faster, having a different sort of story arc. So, this the old idea of the TV advert, you know, the Hollywood story arc where the reveal is right at the end,
Yeah.
paying attention to it online, right? I mean, particularly if you can skip after 3 seconds, right?
Yeah.
You need that heartbeat story arc of some excitement as it comes through, rather than only having the reveal at the end, because you're not going to get people. So it's a different form of storytelling. You can do still on the TVCs, as I kind of said, of, you know, getting the action going faster, you know, typing up colors, or getting tighter on the shots, those sorts of things. But ideally, you've got your creative being done differently, which is, I think, more for me where it comes is there's a secret in there, not necessarily making your creative for the best TVC, but making your creative best for the campaign. So if you're going to have a campaign across TV, social, YouTube, you know, BVOD, and at a home, it needs to work as a 30, a 15, a 10, a 6, a 3, and a static. And so that idea should be expressed like that before any script gets written, which might mean that, you know, it's not the best TV yet, but it's the best campaign that's going to drive across everything. Because there's this huge synergy from combining channels and from having those distinctive assets leverage across. Even, you know, like radio is a massive one, right? How many radio ads are there where it's basically like a read rather than a connection from what you're seeing online? You know, McDonald's is one that stands out, right? Like, you know, that little jingle at the end of their TV ads, which plays on the radio, and you don't even have to be in the room and you've been served McDonald's advertising, right? It's bringing a whole lot of associations to the front of the mind, but so many people aren't doing it. And so it's going through that of making sure that the creative works across everything. And it's, you know, it's that one creative idea being brought across it, rather than people having to reimagine what a creative was thinking when they came up with that TV script.
So that's awesome. Really good summary. Like we probably pick up at the tail end of that in terms of digital, where it is kind of whatever the TVC is, well, let's just run that on YouTube or BVOD, or we'll just chop it up and it'll be fine on, you know, or take this kind of social video content and it'll be fine on TikTok and on YouTube and on Instagram and Facebook and even between our channels, right? Like what works on Instagram versus what works on TikTok are two very, very different things, right? So it's kind of, yeah.
Yeah, I find it really interesting. Since the 60-second TVC is now so expensive, you know, very few people are doing it. It's very hard to make it work. You've got to basically know that you're doing it at a loss now. So people thought that, you know, long-form TV advertising was gone, or maybe the cinema was the only place that you could put it. And actually, the highest ROIs that we see online are long-form advertising. So, you know, even up to like, you know, 90 seconds, 3 minutes. But that's not then like a long ad. It's a story that the brand's in, and a story around the brand. So a different form of storytelling, but it is, you know, like where that true art form of telling a long and interesting story can exist is online. So it's not like creatives need to, you know, somehow compromise themselves or the idea that they want to put out. It can literally start there and then come down.
It's interesting, isn't it? It's got to be like contextually relevant, right? And
Oh,
setting
yeah.
up from the outset as opposed to kind of getting towards the tail end and how do we kind of output this in the formats that are needed.
It's a really interesting point, the contextual part of it there, because you know, there's a lot of chat about, you know, with cookies going, how do you do your behavioral advertising? How do you do your behavioral targeting? Part of me thinks, cool, it stops you doing that thing that you thought was working was never really working, because a lot of the data used for that targeting was iffy at best. You know, there's some great studies even done by you know, Nico Newman at Melbourne Business School, showing that the quality of data from third party, you know, data sets, even gender, was a coin toss accurate, let alone whether you're a dog owner, anything else, right? It was particularly iffy. You were targeting people on data that wasn't great, so how great would the behavioral targeting come out of it? Contextual advertising, though, is 30% better. Plus, it's one of the few things digitally that we can see. Now, I talked before about this massive range of digital performance, but that contextual advertising online is massive. Advertising sports creative on sports websites, it makes sense, right? But it is, I think, getting people to start thinking about how you can do more contextual advertising. And, you know, once again, not just contextual, you know, what I'm suggesting, but how you can get more contextual in, and how you can be smarter about contextual. And that might need to then, you know, play back into the creative brief again.
Interesting. And it feels that that is particularly performance digital where it kind of is heading in this kind of cookieless world. And you look at how, like, no one really knows, but where Google looks to be taking the product a lot, like, I think contextually more relevant than kind of how we're targeting an audience. And the outdoor one's interesting. We had a presentation from oOh!media. And first of all, just they talk so much about the need for outdoor copy, like outdoor advertising is completely different to every other form. And it's kind of like has to be 6 words or less. And they talked a lot about context. And one of the case studies they use, I think, is Cooper's Beer, where they kind of play beautifully into like where the actual sign is located. And there was a good example of one was next door to a tire shop and they used the word tire. And it came together so beautifully. And it clearly wasn't just a chop up of, you know, some other campaign they've been running and trying to make it work across all their outdoor sites. It was kind of an interesting one.
Beer and out of home is really interesting because then you kind of see once again getting that context right of like out of home near pubs has a tremendous ROI. It's massively impactful, but they're like more brand where it makes you feel better about going in and ordering that beer. Whereas in a retail setting, you know, something that's near the liquor stores, it's far more about call to action. It's far more about, you know, price points and offers and that sort of stuff. So even kind of getting that, and then, you know, the performance of out of home for liquor near liquor stores is nowhere near as strong because price just does so much because the price points are so high, right? Their discounting swallows up a huge amount of the impact. But obviously in a pub, you know, there's very little price discounting going on. You don't even know what the price is until they tell you after you've ordered it, right?
It's a lot at the moment.
Yeah, exactly. Jesus, I'm not ordering another one of those. So the impact of that messaging and that format can have so much more. So, you know, even kind of thinking about that of like, where are your sites for out of home or where are your sites online is exactly the same thing.
It's really interesting. It might be a segue or might not be. The space that we play in, I think where all marketers are, right? There's all this talk about AI and jobs going or tasks going and kind of AI doing all these things that, you know, we humans once did. How do you see it impacting your space? Like, is AI just this panacea? Is it a useful tool? Is it all fear mongering? Like, what do you predict in 5 years' time? Are we closing the loop or are we we're still there just as many difficulties and depends and asterisks as there kind of always has been?
See, all of the above. It's definitely helped us, right? Like automation has been massive for us, particularly like data and everything, you know, to the point now where the processes are faster than the data itself and they're able to get it out. And it's putting real pressure on the way that people store data and, you know, the details that they put into the data sets. That processing and transforming of data used to take so long. Now it's almost instantaneous. Having said that, obviously, Gartner put AI at the very peak of their hype cycle in terms of inflated expectations last year. There's people out there spruiking that, you know, it's going to be sentient at the end of the year, at the end of the decade, you know, whatever, with this huge amount of confidence. And are we going to get there? Yes. Are we there now? No. And, you know, one of the proof points for that is hallucinations, right? So, you know, University of Shanghai has done a lot of research into the hallucinations that exist in AI. There's some famous examples of it, right? Like, you know, when Google launched Bard, it wasn't performing very well, and that was because of the hallucinations. You know, Microsoft's Sydney, that was telling people or telling Bing workers it was spying on them, and it was professing its love for users, which is clearly not what they were wanting. There's that famous example with a researcher typing into GPT-3, should I kill myself? And it's saying, yes, you definitely should, which is clearly, you know, not what they wanted. But the hallucinations make sense if you remember what the model's trying to do. Is predict what words should come next off what it's seen and its training data set, right? And if you think a lot of them being trained off the internet, you know, there's some dark, scary places to be, right? Gender bias, there's ethnic bias, loads of horrible things in there. But also, you know, what it tells us is the models weren't, and I would argue still aren't, capable of validating that it's a hallucination. So put it another word, it can't validate the output. So it can't validate the input either. So now, everything that you look at, it's still saying you need a human overview of it. You need human supervision to make sure that those hallucinations don't go through because it still can't validate the output. So I think that's very important to remember when there's people out there spruiking that. You know, my LinkedIn's probably full of some different people to yours, and it's full of a lot of AI experts saying, I am calling BS on this. I am so sick of the lies that are being told. Just trying to bring people back off the hype cycle because, you know, people have these inflated expectations. We're not going to be able to deliver to them. So they want it realistic. We're making huge progress and it's really helpful, but you know, we're not there yet. We still don't believe that AI can produce models independently. It needs that person. Can it speed up a hell of a lot? Yeah, definitely. We've seen huge improvements in the length of time to run our models because of it. But there's that legal and privacy compliance part that comes across at the top, right? There's a lot of people playing with stuff who maybe don't realize the repercussions of it. So we've, like, our legal teams all over it in terms of if you've got a generative AI product, who owns the IP that comes out of it based off what it's been trained on? And that hasn't yet really gone through the courts yet. So stuff that you've done might change. So you've got to be very careful of that. How do you stay compliant with all the data regulations while you're doing that? This could change. So we've got to be really careful. But then, we're doing some fun stuff with it. So if I talked about those training sets of data, we've got what we call the ROI genome at OP. And it's because we've been doing this for 24 years now, we've got hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars across multiple countries, multiple categories within our collective wisdom of the ROI genome. So it's a training set for marketing like nothing else. But within that, we're carving out to say, okay, this is just this client so that we know it's privacy compliant, we know it's legally compliant as well. And then we're creating a product called Ask Gina, where you can use generative AI to ask about your marketing rather than having to, necessarily even click through everything. You can use that sort of a platform. So, we're getting to there. I mean, until they figure out a way to get rid of hallucinations, we keep going, oh, we'll fix that one. And another one comes up. So we're putting the fix in there. So there's constantly having to put fixes on stuff, which tells us we haven't systematically dealt with it yet.
Interesting perspective. In preparing for today, I found it was a really awesome ebook that you guys published a few years back now. I think it was the 20 Insights for 20 Years, which was based on your first 20 years as a consultancy, which we'll link to in the show notes. I think I found it from a written article basically describing one of the graphs as the greatest graph he'd ever seen in the history of marketing, and it basically validated everything he's ever spoken about. But yeah, like really, it's interesting. I think for like a from a firm that deals so much in data, so much of it was also just kind of themes and concepts, which we try to kind of help our clients with as well. And like probably where you kicked off the show in terms of just cross-function and stakeholders and like how do you actually set yourself up for success. But with definitely recommend anyone interested in today downloading a copy of that. But do you guys publish much by because you've shared lots of stats with us from your own data? Are there ways that listeners can access that if they are interested and are available?
Yeah, we're constantly putting out white papers. We're constantly putting out what we call genome flashes. Actually, if you go onto the website and sign up, you will be deployed every time that we put out new content. You'll be sent through that content. It's definitely something that we're trying to do, which is just pass on that wisdom, which is where the likes of Ritson kind of found it. We put it out. It's a pretty rigorous approach that we do of making sure that it is generalizable because we go across so many countries, across so many categories. We make sure that it is a replicable finding across. All of the studies to do it, and obviously that there's enough data behind it that it's not relying on one category or one industry to
Awesome.
make it. But yeah, it's insight that comes out that I would definitely recommend go and sign up, and we send it out probably at least once a month.
Yeah, awesome.
Content comes out.
We'll include a link to that. Paul, it's been awesome chatting to you. We finish every episode with this question. What's your best piece of career advice for an in-house marketer?
Don't change things. Consistency, I think, are really important. It's interesting as well, you're kind of saying before about the themes and stuff and patterns and stuff that you'd help people. I think don't get so caught up by the new fads and the new shiny toys. I sometimes feel like a bit of a fraud in telling people I'm literally pulling out 1950s insights for them. Sometimes it feels like, right? But it's still true. There's a foundational knowledge in marketing that's been built up over by time. It's been tested time and time again, and it still stands up. Don't think that some new shiny toy coming out challenges that. Have confidence on the foundational work that sits there, which is something that Mr. Ritson says himself, right? Get that foundational knowledge and move on. So one, don't change your campaigns until you're really, really sure. That needs to be a massive kind of bar that's set there. But also don't change your understanding of marketing because of something new and shiny has come along.
It's absolutely brilliant. And I think for those marketers out there that are worried about AI, I think sticking to those foundational concepts, understanding what the purpose marketing plays in an organization and what role it is as you as a senior marketer will put you in good stead many, many years into the future. Cool. Paul, thank you so much for coming on. It's been a great chat.
No worries. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, mate. Thanks for listening to the Smarter Marketer podcast. Stay up to date about new episodes on LinkedIn and Instagram by searching for Smarter Marketer podcast. You can purchase your own copy of Smarter Marketer via the Amazon website. And if you want a second opinion about your business's approach to digital marketing, send me an email, jamesl@rocketagency.com.au, or visit the rocketagency.com.au website. Thanks for your time.